Chapter 30. Praetorian surrounded the groves on the banks of the pond of Agrippa, lest over numerous throngs of spectators might annoy Caesar and his guests, though it was said that everything in Rome distinguished for wealth, beauty, or intellect was present at that feast, which had no equal in the history of the city. Tigellinus wished to recompense Caesar for the deferred journey to Achaia, to surpass all who had ever feasted Nero, and prove that no man could entertain as he could. With this object in view, while with Caesar in Naples, and later in Beneventum, he had made preparations and sent orders to bring from the remotest regions of the earth beasts, birds, rare fish, and plants, not omitting vessels and cloths, which were to enhance the splendor of the feast. The revenues of whole provinces went to satisfy mad projects, but the powerful favorite had no need to hesitate. His influence grew daily. Tigellinus was not dearer than others to Nero yet, perhaps, but he was becoming more and more indispensable. Petronius surpassed him infinitely in polish, intellect, wit. In conversation he knew better how to amuse Caesar. But to his misfortune he surpassed in conversation Caesar himself, hence he roused his jealousy. Moreover, he could not be an obedient instrument in everything, and Caesar feared his opinion when there were questions in matters of taste. But before Tigellinus, Nero never felt any restraint. The very title, Arbiter Legantiarum, which had been given to Petronius, annoyed Nero's vanity, for who had the right to bear that title but himself? Tigellinus had sense enough to know his own deficiencies, and seeing that he could not compete with Petronius, Lucan, or others distinguished by birth, talents, or learning, he resolved to extinguish them by the suppleness of his services, and above all by such a magnificence that the imagination of Nero himself would be struck by it. He had arranged to give the feast on a gigantic raft, framed of gilded timbers. The borders of this raft were decked with splendid shells found in the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean, shells perfluorescent with the colors of pearls and the rainbow. The banks of the pond were covered with groups of palm, with groves of lotus, and blooming roses. In the midst of these were hidden fountains of perfumed water, statues of gods and goddesses, and gold or silver cages filled with birds of various colors. In the center of the raft rose an immense tent, or rather, not to hide the feasters, only the roof of a tent, made of Syrian purple, resting on silver columns. Under it were gleaming, like suns, tables prepared for the guests, loaded with Alexandrian glass, crystal, and vessels simply beyond price, the plunder of Italy, Greece, and Asia Minor. The raft, which because of plants accumulated on it at the appearance of an island and a garden, was joined by cords of gold and purple to boats shaped like fish, swans, mews, and flamingos, in which sat at painted oars naked rowers of both sexes, with forms and features of marvelous beauty, their hair dressed in oriental fashion, or gathered in golden nets. When Nero arrived at the main raft with Pompey and the Augustians, and sat beneath the purple tent roof, the oars struck the water, the boats moved, the golden cords stretched, and the raft with the feast, and the guests began to move and describe circles on the pond. Other boats surrounded it, and other smaller rafts, filled with women playing on cithara and harps, women whose rosy bodies on the blue background of the sky and the water and in the reflections from golden instruments seemed to absorb that blue and those reflections, and to change, and bloom like flowers. From the groves at the banks, from fantastic buildings reared for that day and hidden among thickets, were heard music and song. The neighborhood resounded, the groves resounded. Echoes bore around the voices of horns and trumpets. Caesar himself, with Pompey on one side of him, and Pythagoras on the other, was amazed, and more especially when among the boats young slave maidens appeared as sirens, and were covered with green network in imitation of scales. He did not spare praises on Tigellinus. But he looked at Petronius from habit, wishing to learn the opinion of the arbiter, who seemed indifferent for a long time, and only when questioned outright, answered, Judge, Lord, that 10,000 naked maidens make less impression than one. But the loading feast pleased Caesar, for it was something new. Besides, such exquisite dishes were served, that the imagination of Apicius would have failed at sight of them, and wines of so many kinds that Otho, who used to serve 80, would have hidden under water with shame, could he have witnessed the luxury of that feast. Besides women, the Augustans sat down at the table, among whom Vinicius excelled all with his beauty. Formerly his figure and face indicated too clearly the soldier by profession. Now mental suffering, and the physical pain through which he had passed had chiseled his features, as if the delicate hand of a master had passed over them. His complexion had lost its former swarthiness, but the yellowish gleam of Numidian marble remained on it. His eyes had grown larger and more pensive. His body had retained its former powerful outlines, as if created for armor, but above the body of a legionary was seen the head of a Grecian god, or at least of a refined patrician, at once subtle and splendid. Petronius, in saying that none of the ladies of Caesar's court would be able or willing to resist Vinicius, spoke like a man of experience. All gazed at him now, not excepting Poppaea, or the Vestal Virgin Rubria, whom Caesar wished to see at the feast. Wines, cooled in mountain snow, soon warmed the hearts and heads of the guests. Boats shaped as grasshoppers or butterflies shot forth from the bushes at the shore every moment. The blue surface of the pond seemed occupied by butterflies. Above the boats here and there flew doves, and other birds from India and Africa, fastened with silver and blue threads or strings. The sun had passed the greater part of the sky, but the day was warm and even hot, though in the beginning of May. The pond heaved from the strokes of oars, which beat the water in time with music, but in the air there was not the least breath of wind. The groves were motionless, as if lost in listening and in gazing at that which was happening on the water. The raft circled continually on the pond, bearing guests who were increasingly drunk and boisterous. The feast had not run half its course yet, when the order in which all sat at the table was observed no longer. Caesar gave the example, for, rising himself, he commanded Vinicius, who sat next to Rubria the Vestal, to move. Nero occupied the place, and began to whisper something in Rubria's ear. Vinicius found himself next to Poppaea, who extended her arm, and begged him to fasten her loosened bracelet. When he did so, with hands trembling somewhat, she cast at him from beneath her long lashes a glance as it were of modesty, and shook her golden head, as if in resistance. Meanwhile the sun, growing larger, ruddier, sank slowly behind the tops of the grove. The guests were for the greater part thoroughly intoxicated. The raft circled now nearer the shore, on which, among bunches of trees and flowers, were seen groups of people, disguised as faun or satyrs, playing on flutes, bagpipes, and drums, with groups of maidens representing nymphs, dryads, and hamadryads. Darkness fell at last amid drunken shouts from the tent, shouts raised in honor of Luna. Meanwhile the groves were lighted with 1,000 lamps. From the lupinaria on the shores shone swarms of lights. On the terraces appeared new naked groups, formed of the wives and daughters of the first Roman houses. These with voice and unrestrained manner began to lure partners. The raft touched the shore at last. Caesar and the Augustians vanished in the groves, scattered in lupinaria, in tents hidden in thickets, in grottos artificially arranged among fountains and springs. Madness seized all. No one knew whither Caesar had gone. No one knew who was a senator, who a knight, who a dancer, who a musician. Satyrs and fauns fell to chasing nymphs with shouting. They struck lamps with thyrses to quench them. Darkness covered certain parts of the grove. Everywhere, however, laughter and shouts were heard, and whispers, and panting breaths. In fact, Rome had not seen anything like that before. Vinicius was not drunk, as he had been at the feast in Nero's palace, when Lygia was present, but he was roused, and intoxicated by the sight of everything done round about, and at last the fever of pleasure seized him. Rushing into the forest, he ran, with others, examining who of the dryads seemed most beautiful. New flocks of these raced around him every moment with shouts and with songs. These flocks were pursued by fauns, satyrs, senators, knights, and by sounds of music. Seeing at last a band of maidens led by one arrayed as Diana, he sprang to it, intending to examine the goddess more closely. All at once the heart sank in his bosom, for he thought that in that goddess, with the moon on her forehead, he recognized Lygia. They encircled him with a mad whirl, and, wishing evidently to incline him to follow, rushed away the next moment like a herd of deer. But he stood on the spot with beating heart, breathless. For though he saw that the Diana was not Lygia, and that at close sight she was not even like her, the too powerful impression deprived him of strength. Straightway he was seized by such yearning as he had never felt before, and love for Lygia rushed to his breast in a new, immense wave. Never had she seemed so dear, pure, and beloved as in that forest of madness on a frenzied excess. A moment before, he himself wished to drink of that cup, and share in that shameless letting loose of the senses. Now disgust and repugnance possessed him. He felt that infamy was stifling him, that his breast needed air and the stars which were hidden by the thickets of that dreadful grove. He determined to flee, but barely had he moved when before him stood some veiled figure, which placed its hands on his shoulders and whispered, flooding his face with burning breath, "Love thee. Come. No one will see us. Hasten." Vinicius was roused, as if from a dream. "Who art thou?" But she leaned her breast on him and insisted, "Hurry. See how lonely it is here, and I love thee. Come. Who art thou?" repeated Vinicius. "Guess." As she said this, she pressed her lips to his through the veil, drawing toward her his head at the same time, till at last breath failed the woman and she tore her face from him. "Knight of love, knight of madness," said she, catching the air quickly. "Tita day is free, thou hast me." But that kiss burned Vinicius. It filled him with disquiet. His soul and heart were elsewhere. In the whole world nothing existed for him except Lygia. So, pushing back the veiled figure, he said, "Whoever thou be, I love another, I do not wish thee." "Ah, remove the veil," said she, lowering her head toward him. At that moment the leaves of the nearest myrtle began to rustle. The veiled woman vanished like a dream vision, but from a distance her laugh was heard, strange in some way, and ominous. Petronius stood before Vinicius. "I have heard and seen," said he. "Let us go from this place," replied Vinicius. And they went. They passed the Lupinaria gleaming with light, the grove, the line of mounted Praetorians, and found the litters. "I will go with thee," said Petronius. They sat down together. On the road both were silent, and only in the atrium of Vinicius's house did Petronius ask, "Dost thou know who that was?" "Was it Rubria?" asked Vinicius, repulsed at the very thought that Rubria was a Vestal. "Who then?" Petronius lowered his voice. "The fire of Vesta was defiled, for Rubria was with Caesar." But with he was speaking, and he finished in a still lower voice, "the divine Augusta." A moment of silence followed. "Caesar," said Petronius, "was unable to hide from Poppaea his desire for Rubria, therefore she wished, perhaps, to avenge herself. But I hindered you both. Hadst thou recognized the Augusta and refused her, thou wouldst have been ruined beyond rescue, thou, Lygia, and I, perhaps. I have enough of Rome, Caesar, feasts, the augusta one to Gelinus, and all of you," burst out Vinicius. "I am stifling. I cannot live thus. I cannot. Dost understand me? Vinicius, thou art losing sense, judgment, moderation. I love only her in this world. What of that? This, that I wish no other love. I have no wish for your life, your feasts, your shamelessness, your crimes. What is taking place in thee? Art thou a Christian?" The young man seized his head with both hands, and repeated, as if in despair, "Not yet, not yet." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.